This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell.
I want you to understand, here are the stated goals of the climate strike, which you can see for yourself at globalclimatestrike.net. In quotes, to ensure a rapid energy revolution with equity, reparations, and climate justice at its heart, end of quote. I mean, they want a total ban on fracking, exploration, and other extraction techniques. No new coal projects, no mention of hundreds of thousands out of work in Canada, by the way, or millions worldwide. They reject carbon capture and all other what they call techno fixes. I want you to think about that one. Reduce emissions without technological advancement. Can anyone find a scientist who thinks that's realistic? They reject private property rights. Did you ever wonder what happened to the G7 or G8, G20 anti-capitalist protesters? Well, many are behind the climate strikes. Just go to climatestrike.org, see for yourself. This is what public education is endorsing. The goal of the climate strikers isn't to reduce emissions, or better put, find a way to power our society while dramatically reducing emissions at an acceptable cost. Instead, catastrophic climate change is the vehicle for a political agenda as reflected in their stated goals, including things like transferring tens of billions of dollars in wealth redistribution from developed nations to underdeveloped ones. Yet school boards in BC, many others in the educational establishment across the country, mindlessly supported the strike while the media uncritically reported on it. A victory for everyone in favor of superficiality on this incredibly complex issue. But there's far more to it than that. For well over a year, it's been obvious the new strategy of climate activists and their political and media allies is to announce that climate change is an emergency, a catastrophe, even extinction is just around the corner if we don't act immediately. Just this month, The New Yorker ran a headline in quotes, "What if we stop pretending the climate apocalypse can be stopped?" End of quote. I mean, do you think that the fact that we've seen Armageddon so regularly predicted before, you remember things like the fallout from acid rain or the depletion of the ozone layer, the coming ice age, Paul Ehrlich got very popular talking about the population bomb, Al Gore's declaration that the polar ice caps would all melt by 2014. One of my personal favorites, the International Panel on Climate Change forecast there'd be no snow in the Himalayas by now, only to admit later that there was absolutely no science behind the supported claim. It was in the report, but they'd taken it from the Sierra Club and bogusly claimed it was scientifically backed. So given that, before accepting the alarmist claim that extinction is around the corner if the Earth warms by, say, 2 or 3 or 4%, you'd think we'd ask for the science, especially given so many children are being told they're going to die. What you should note is that the term climate denier now covers anyone, including well-known climate scientists who are on record as saying climate change is real, action must be taken, but they dare to question the alarmist agenda, including insisting on reviewing the various cost-benefit analysis of policy recommendations. And sadly, school boards in cities like Vancouver and Surrey and other across Canada endorse this no questions, no critical thinking allowed of the alarmist agenda, regardless of the lack of scientific research to back up claims of catastrophe if, as 16-year-old media darling Greta Thunberg states, we don't take action in the next 5 years. Let me come back just for a second to the climate strike goals as an illustration. The elimination of all fossil fuels by 2030, the move to 100% renewables, popular refrain espoused in the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Green New Deal. But you might also want to note that when she was pressed about that 2030 timeline, she said, if you believe it, you literally have to have the intelligence of a sea sponge. The co-author of the International Panel on Climate Change report, James Skia, simply stated that the IPCC, in quotes, did not say we have 12 years left to save the world, end of quote. Someone should have told the students. But it's far more than the timeline. It's the simplicity of the proposed solutions to such a complex problem that the students should be made aware of. I wonder if they know that building one wind turbine requires 900 tons of steel, something like 2,500 to 3,000 tons of concrete, 40 tons of non-recyclable plastic. All of that, of course, manufactured with high CO2 emissions. What about solar panels? Well, there is a well-documented problem right now surrounding what to do with old ones. According to the International Renewable Energy Agency, the Paris Accord's solar goals for 2050 will necessitate disposing of old panels that are the equivalent of more than double the total tonnage of all the world's plastic waste today. The point is, it's not as easy as it sounds to simply demand 100% renewable energy in just over a decade. Too bad the educational establishment, including some teachers, are satisfied with sloganeering over critical thinking. The fact is, since 1992, Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit, our use of renewable energy has increased by from 13.1% of the total energy needs to just 14.2%. The student should be discussing the reasons why the overwhelming consensus from people as diverse as Bill Gates to James Hansen, that's the scientist who first introduced global warming in 1988, stating that renewables cannot replace fossil fuels. In fact, James Hansen goes so far as to calling the idea grotesque. And he's got a lot of company in the climate change community, as well as the Gates Foundation, who after extensive study with some of the top scientists, engineers on the planet, concluded that the only viable way to replace energy from fossil fuels and dramatically reducing emissions was to develop a new way of harnessing nuclear energy. It's called traveling wave reactors, which would run on depleted uranium. I mean, the foundation's already committed over $1 billion to the project. You know, Canada's educational establishment regularly states that the goal is to teach students to think critically. Well, the climate alarmism they endorse is the antithesis of that. The climate strike organizers have no interest in critical evaluation of their agenda and demands, which are anti-science, anti-technology, a lot of anti-freedom. But to say nothing of how glibly they're pushing so many people out of work, maybe 400,000 in Canada, millions worldwide. But one final point, I could go on. This is a big subject. There's lots to talk about. Only one final point. That's the time. And it's arguably the biggest irony of the climate strikes. The student protesters don't show any sign that they're aware that no generation in history has consumed more petroleum product than theirs, be it the plastic in their cell phones, popular fashion sneakers, polyester in their clothes. No generation has consumed more electricity thanks to things like streaming video and texting and Instagram. Using a cell phone for just an hour a day produces a ton of CO2 emissions annually. And come on, it's a good bet that a lot of those students are using their phones a lot more than an hour a day. Worse still, a lot of those young people trade in their phones, not because they don't work, but because they want the latest, which further increases the carbon footprint. The generation protesting has traveled more by air, consumed more goods that come from more places in the world than ever before, lived in homes that on average are bigger, consume more energy than any other time in history. You know what would have been impressive? If the climate strikers had made a major gesture demonstrating their commitment to take action. After all, that's what they're demanding. They could have maybe all got together and thrown their cell phones into a big pile at the center of the protest, pledged not to take a car for any distance under 3 kilometers, and instead walk. You know what? Past generations did that. But no, they didn't make any such gesture. No change in lifestyle promised. And that's the big irony, because the protests are about leaders who Greta Thunberg correctly points out are all talk and no action. Chalk another one up for virtue signaling. Very pleased to welcome back to the show Andrew Ruling. He's president, Integrated Wealth Management in Calgary. Time for the big fat idea. I'm going to get right to it with you, Andrew. What's your big fat idea?
Well, good morning, Mike. My big fat idea is pretty straightforward. I hate government bonds, long-term government bonds, because they're basically a financial death trap for investors.
Well, we got a big scare this past week with the repo market, you know, the overnight lending, and it jumps to 10%. I put that as just another one of my milestones that we've got some problems in the financial system. So what do you, when you say you're going to be out of longer-term bonds, what are some of the things that are motivating you there?
Longer-term government bonds, in a larger context. Canadian 10-year bonds, they closed yesterday with a yield of 1.387%. In the U.S., a 10-year at 1.68% and a 30-year bond at 2.13%. That's before taxes and before inflation. And in the U.K., yields are about half of what they are in the U.S. Now, that's bad enough because that punishes retirees who need income for, you know, from their portfolio to maintain their lifestyle. And then we look at Europe. So the approximate value of negative yielding bonds, and it's mostly Europe, is about a $17 trillion equivalent. And again, those are concentrated in Europe, particularly Germany. But some of that, and that's German bonds, sovereign bonds, but some of that is now actually starting to spread to European corporate bonds. So basically, they've squeezed all the blood from the stone, and they're down to the marrow right now. Mm-hmm. So things are really, they're going to get toxic. And when when rates eventually start to rise, probably not from a fantastic economy, but from a drop in confidence in government, we're going to see major capital risk, and that's because of how the bond pricing model works. And I mean, the creditworthiness of governments is almost never publicly questioned, but decades of unrestrained spending will eventually, they're going to bite governments as rates rise and interest payments become larger and larger line item expenditures. So it's going to paint governments into a corner.
Let me just very quickly, because I know you're doing a seminar after the show that is available to Money Talks listeners, where obviously you get a chance to go into it further here, just talking about protecting yourself and making sure that they're, you know, thriving and then surviving in that kind of an environment. And you're doing it right after the show immediately, and you'll get a chance to go more into this. But just give me a chance or a sampling, rather, of what are you looking at instead? Because there's still people out there, and I know Aaron Dunn's going to talk about this, is how to get, you know, some of us still need income from our investments, like, you
Absolutely,
know, on an annual
right?
or a regular basis. Yeah.
Yes. So you need to look at some viable replacements because, of course, nature abhors a vacuum. You know, typically people have 30 to 40% or more in fixed income in retirement. Now you can't count on that because it will be low yielding or, in fact, could be financially destructive. So we look at typically a combination of corporate bonds, preferred shares, high-yield dividend stocks, as well as some pretty specialized high-yielding private alternatives. And we'll talk about those on the webinar right after the show as well.
Yeah, so you're making obviously a distinction between government bonds and corporate bonds.
Correct.
Okay, so when you're looking at that, have you found a big change in that market, for example, though? When they're watching the kind of yields you just alluded to in the 10-year Canada bond, have we had a similar drop, you know, strong drop in yields of preferred shares as you know, interest rates have dropped?
Well, in preferred shares, there's been recent underperformance there. The yields typically in a basket of preferred shares are north of 5%. But recent underperformance makes it more likely that we're going to see some more capital coming into that asset class, so bidding those up.
And you say high-yielding private alternatives.
Well, private markets, just like private business, there's, you know, probably many Money Talks listeners who are private business owners. They know they can get a higher return in their private business because you don't have the daily pressures of looking after shareholders. You can think longer term. And so we have a stable of really carefully selected private alternatives that that yield considerably higher even than preferred shares.
And the other thing to get for people to be crystal clear on is that, you know, central banks don't set interest rates. They set these very, very short-term rates, you know, but if people start losing confidence, for example, we've watched it now in emerging markets. I just use an obvious example, you know, where Turkey's interest rates went from 10 to 24% in a year. Why? Because no one was going to lend to them. And, you know, if that starts snowballing, and especially I'm particularly worried, Andrew, about the degree of central bank intervention, for example, in Europe, has rendered their bond market sort of helpless. It's not hard to understand. I mean, I'll put the offer out today. Anybody want to buy a negative yield bond where you maybe give them $100,000 and they guarantee to give you $90,000 back? Nobody wants any of that. There's no bond market left.
Exactly. And frankly, the European Central Bank in particular has basically painted itself into a corner and they got nothing.
They got nothing is right. That's right. Interesting. Protect and prosper through the coming global crisis. That's the webinar. Andrew's going to do it right after the show. All you have to do is go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and you can register, but it's going to begin right after the show. Get to the Goofy Award and then go on to that. Andrew will get a chance to flesh out these very important, bigger ideas there. So go to mikesmoneytalks.net. Unfortunately, when they do a webinar like this and we want to follow up with more information, there's a limited number who can get on the platform. So, I'll tell you, this is an incredibly important subject. As I say, the repo market gave us a huge hint at the urgency involved with this. Andrew, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure, Mike.
Time now for this week's Instant Wisdom. Hey, we're in a federal election campaign, so what a good time to talk about the importance of telling the truth. Okay, don't roll your eyes. After all, I get it. From an early age, we've been taught that through stories like The Boy Who Cried Wolf or Pinocchio. We've been told to tell the truth, or at least don't lie. Yeah, come on. We've clearly arrived at a time in our social discourse look at Twitter, look at Facebook, and in our political affairs, where purposely misleading statements and outright lying seem to be commonplace. I love this comment by the Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan. She's looking at Obamacare, but it could have been applied to so many leaders, political parties, special interest groups on so many different issues. But she said, the leaders of our government have not felt throughout the process that they had any responsibility to be honest. I mean, it's hard to escape the observation that honesty and integrity are not high on our list of priorities any longer when it comes to politics and political discourse. For many, it's okay when our guy lies, or it's okay to issue misleading statements when we agree with the position. So we may have heard the parable of the boy who cried wolf or the story of Pinocchio, but we didn't learn the lesson. In this week's installment of Instant Wisdom, Jordan Peterson talks about his eighth rule from the massive bestseller 12 Rules for Life, an anecdote to chaos, where he talks about the importance of not lying and instead telling the truth. Here's the clip.
Lies make you weak and you can feel it. It's the antithesis of meaning, I would say, because meaning is associated with the truth. So if you're lying, you're at the opposite pole of that. That's the deceit part. And it makes you weak. You think, well, I'll lie and I'll get away with it. It's like, no, you won't. You cannot get away with warping the structure of being. Well, that's why the arrogance comes in. It's like, well, I can lie and get away with it. It's like, I see. Here's your theory. There's all this reality around you that you don't comprehend at all. And there's not that much of you. There's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do something that isn't in harmony with that, and it's going to work. That's your theory. It's like,
That's some serious narcissism. Yeah, yeah. And yet we all do that to some degree, or at least at some point in our lives, right? All think we can manage everything.
Well, it's part because you can get away with it for a short period of time, right? So you think, well, I've got away with it so far. It's like, yeah. It's like that funny line in The Simpsons. Bart comes up to Homer and says, Dad, this is the worst day of my life. And Homer says, the worst day of your life so far, Bart. The worst day of your life so far.
Time now for this week's quote of the week. Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which I'd recommend you read, was written in 1957. Incredibly, has been on a bestseller list for 4 decades. If you want to increase your education, read the book. It sold tens of millions of copies. But what's really amazing, as you'll see from this quote, is that it's as pertinent today as it was over 50 years ago. In quotes, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing. When you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors. When you see that men get rich more easily by graft than by work, and your laws no longer protect you against them, but protect them against you, you may know your society is doomed. Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand. I would, as I say, recommend it to complete anyone's education or to enhance anyone's education. Very pleased to welcome back to the show Aaron Dunn. A great lead-in today from Andrew Ruland, who's doing a seminar webinar right at the end of our show here on Money Talks. You can go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, click on join that webinar. But talking about the kind of environment that we're in right now, this back to a lower interest rate environment, people are saying, what do I do? Real worries about some of the quality of longer-term government debt. Well, what a perfect person to have with me, Aaron Dunn, Keystone Financial. Aaron, first of all, appreciate you taking time on the weekend.
Oh, I'm always happy to do it, Michael. Always happy to chat on a Saturday morning.
Well, there's so much to chat about. I mean, people are saying, what do I do with my money? I mean, that's not unusual. But again, we're back to that environment that, as Andrew alluded to, we're worried that people, in order to get a better yield, are taking more risk. You know, it's the same old sort of creditworthy thing. If I'll lend you money because I know you always pay it back, and I'm worried about the next guy, so I charge him more. That's how you get higher rates in a lot of instances. Now it's getting more complicated with government and central bank intervention, but that's the bottom line. So talk to me a little bit about how you're approaching the market today.
Well, we take a very consistent approach to the market, so it doesn't change every month or every quarter as, you know, the macroeconomic outlook changes. What we've always told people is you need to have a mix of different types of companies in your portfolio. That's how you're going to build a robust long-term portfolio that's going to perform well and manage risk in a variety of different economic scenarios. So that does start with dividend growth stocks, what we call dividend growth stocks. So high-quality companies paying attractive dividends and growing those dividends over time in a sustainable way. And if you look at the data, and we've talked about this a lot at our DIY seminars as well, if you look at the data, the conclusion is just it's you can't argue it. Dividend growth stocks have vastly outperformed non-dividend paying companies overall over essentially almost any time horizon you look at. Over the last 30 years, for instance, annualized returns overall about 11.6% compared to 0.3% for non-dividend payers. And they're doing this as well with lower risk. So we believe the best way to construct a portfolio long-term is you start off with dividend growth stocks. That forms the foundation of your portfolio. And then you mix in, you can add layers of risk to augment that return. And so that's what we do with our small cap research as well. So these are still high quality companies generating a lot of cash flow, growing a little more risky than our dividend payers, but you're augmenting your return by adding these companies to your portfolio. And then you also look outside of Canadian borders as well, so that you get good geographic diversification. Because our economy here in Canada is just so limited, you need to access the global market. And there's two ways you can do that. One is a lot of the recommendations that we make in our Canadian research are Canadian listed companies that are actually operating globally and have exposure to the United States, other global markets, emerging markets. Another way to do that is you can actually buy companies that are listed in other countries. So we have our U.S. research service as well, U.S. growth stocks, where we look at companies on the NASDAQ, the New York Exchange, in some cases, the very highest level of the OTC, to really try and get a good global exposure in the portfolio. So you take these different types of companies, you mix them together, you focus on quality, and that's how you're going to build a portfolio that's going to be successful for you long term and manage risk.
I just want to mention also that you've got a group of seminars coming up. That go to Kamloops, go to Victoria. You'll be in Vancouver, of course. You're going to Langley. There's a whole list there that people can just get from going to KeystoneFinancial.com. KeystoneFinancial.com. But this is the kind of thing that you're dealing with. And this is what I really encourage people, to have a look at, simply because, learn how to build a portfolio. It won't be over your head or anything like that, but there's proper ways to approach it. And I know you're in Kamloops October 15th. You're in Victoria October 16th. You're at Langley the following day. The following week, October 22nd in Vancouver, Calgary October 23rd, Edmonton the 24th. So I really encourage people. That's the kind of thing, if it's one of those subjects, I always hear about people don't have a financial plan or they don't really understand it. That's the kind of thing you do. Aaron and Ryan Irvine do a great job of explaining, how to set up a portfolio, what kind of things you should think about and just go through. I mean, that's what we're doing here, is trying to help people out in that way. And especially in this environment. And I know you guys spend all your time looking at and different categories, like you have growth with yield, you have higher level growth, which we've talked about. But just in order, time's never long enough here. But give me an example of something that you're looking at these days, that I'm focusing. Ryan, we had Ryan on a few weeks ago and did a great job talking about some of the more aggressive growth stocks, small caps that they're looking at. But give me something like a solid company with a dividend that you're looking at.
Absolutely. Happy to do that. Just to clarify the website, it's actually keystocks.com.
Of course it is.
People can go to, no problem. People can go to keystocks.com, get all the information on the DIY seminars. And just like you said, what we're doing is we're breaking down 20 years of experience in the market and providing people with a simple process and framework to build a portfolio, avoid unnecessary risk, and really avoid many pitfalls that hurt investors. But just on the topic of a very solid dividend growth stock, I'm going to talk about a company that's been a longstanding recommendation in our research. That's Brookfield Infrastructure. The symbol is BIP.UN on the TSX, BIP on the New York Stock Exchange. I've talked about it on your show many, many times. So Brookfield, this is a global infrastructure company, a very solid conservative stock, but also a growth company as well. So they own infrastructure projects all over the world, and these are long life, stable projects that generate stable cash flow. So you look at a company like this, it's growing, but its current cash flow is also very well positioned for a recessionary environment. We originally recommended the company in 2011 at $14.50 per unit. Today it trades at $66 per unit, so great return in terms of capital appreciation based on the financial performance. But what really impresses me is that they have paid out about $12 US in income distributions to their investors over this 8-year period. So that's $12 US. We recommended them at $14.50 Canadian. You basically have your money back on a pre-tax basis and a company that's continuing to grow. So I know you always ask, well, it's done great in the past, so why are you still recommending it in the future? Well, they are continuing to grow. So the recent financial performance has been strong, low double-digit growth in cash flow per unit. They have an investment backlog of about $2.2 billion U.S. that they are commissioning over the next 3 years. So we're expecting 2020 to actually be an excellent year of growth. And this is a company that just continues to produce. It pays a very nice yield of about 4%. It's growing that yield every year. The unit price has been appreciating. We believe that the income distribution is very sustainable. The growth is sustainable. And even though it's come up a lot over the past 8 years, we still think relative to the quality that it's trading at a reasonable price. Now, this isn't a company that I want people to go out and buy because they want to get a big return in the next 6 months. That may happen. It's had a great year in 2019, up about 40% so far. But we want people to look at a company like this as something that they want to own and generate income from for at least the next 3 to 5 years. And that's what we're recommending it for. So great long-standing recommendation, but we still think that it has a good, solid future.
Well, one of the things I always like that you guys look into is, okay, so you can pay a dividend, but you've got to think how sustainable that dividend is. You know, and there's some, and as you know, you reject many, many companies on that basis. You say, yeah, they paid 6%, but I don't trust them. They're not paying that going forward. So that's one of the things I like about the research that you guys do, is that you have a long look at, hey, fine, it's a great yield, 4%. But is it, can they maintain it? And you go further, of course, in this case, you've just said that it can increase it also, the distributions. But I'm just reminding people, don't get mesmerized by the yield on something. You've got to look at that aspect too, which you've had with Brookfield Infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely. If it was just about finding companies with high yields, my job would be super easy.
Yeah.
often the companies with the highest yields are ones you want to avoid. So we're trying to find those companies with good, generous yield, sustainable in the future, and that they're also able to continue to grow those dividend payouts as well. And that's what really produces returns in the market.
Aaron, we're talking about, you know, I put you on the spot and said, give me a couple of quality stocks that you look at for this side of your portfolio. You focus on, you know, solid growth. You do a great job delineating what you're talking about. Sometimes you have a hybrid growth and dividend. Some are straight dividend sort of payers. Give me another example.
Sure. So I have a really interesting company for you, actually. One of the things we do at our DIY seminar is we break down what are hot themes and discuss whether or not investors should invest in them and how they should approach them. So cannabis, blockchain, crypto, AI, big data. And one space that we really like is cybersecurity. Just the way that the world is digitalizing, the advancements in technology, obviously that opens us up to attack. And we hear all the time about big enterprises being hacked and there being data leaks, and there's a huge economic cost to that. So cybersecurity is a space that in enterprises cannot afford not to invest in long term. They have to continue to invest in that. And a recommendation I have from that sector is a company called Fortinet. It's FTNT. It trades on the NASDAQ. So this is a company from our U.S. growth stock service. So it is a pure play cybersecurity stock. It's one of the largest cybersecurity companies in the world, 360,000 customers globally. It's a company that is acquiring market share, so it's growing its market share in the global cybersecurity space. And the sector overall is a growth area, growing at about 11% or more per year is what it's projected over the next several years. And we think that's just going to continue going on as the world digitalizes and companies need to protect themselves. So this is a company that it's not about hype. So we really separate quality businesses from the hype. There's a lot of, anytime you have a hot theme, there's a lot of companies that will just try and jump on that and say they're part of this space to gain excitement. But Fortinet is a cash flow positive business. They're growing their revenues. They're growing their cash flow at a phenomenal rate. They're expected this year. They just upgraded their guidance, so they increased their guidance after they put out their second quarter results. They're expecting 17% growth in revenue this year, about 22% growth in earnings per share. So we think that is a trend that you can really profit from long term, and Fortinet is a way to play that trend. One thing I love about Fortinet is that It's fundamentally, it's so strong. So it's a cash-rich company. It has over $10 per share in net cash on its balance sheet. Stock price is trading at about $76. And it's actually trading at a relatively attractive valuation, a very reasonable valuation relative to its free cash flow. So when you take the net cash balance out of the stock price, it's really trading at about 16, 17 times this year's expected free cash flow. And that's a very reasonable valuation for a company that is growing, acquiring market share in an attractive space like cybersecurity. And just once again, this is an example of investing outside of Canada too, which is why we have our U.S. growth stock service. Companies like Fortinet simply just don't exist up here. So you really have to go down to the United States to find them. And we're finding some very interesting opportunities down there that you can't access here in Canada.
But it's a great example of, a lot of times investors say, you know, they like a sector. You know, they've done it, you know, I mean, one of the ones that jumps to mind right now is, you know, going back a year or two, marijuana sector. But that doesn't mean you're choosing the right stocks. And cybersecurity, thanks to Jim Dines coming on this show, gosh, several years ago, and just said, you wait, this is going to be massive. Seems obvious now, but at the time he said it, it sure wasn't, saying this is going to be massive, the cybersecurity industry. But then it's the job, and that's what you do, of course, Aaron, but the job is to find, okay, which companies are best suited to take advantage of that space. And as you say, you're looking at the growth rate, 17%, you know, fantastic. But it's a great example of the kind of thing you'll do. And it's sort of an example of the kind of thing you're going to be talking about, you know, at your huge list of seminars. So I'm going to remind people again, go to keystocks.com and click on the DIY stock investment seminars, because as I say, they're coming throughout British Columbia, into Alberta, into Ontario. And so get the dates. And as I say, that's the kind of thing, I love it when people are doing that, simply because that's how you get a framework, an intellectual framework, to hear the information you get, to approach the markets, that kind of thing. Learn how to reduce risk and balance your portfolio. So I'm kind of looking forward to that, Aaron. And great stuff as usual. There's so much to talk about these days. Appreciate you finding time.
Oh, I'm always happy to do it. Thanks a lot for having me, Michael. And we look forward to seeing your listeners at DIY events. We really believe that this is the best investment somebody can make with their time. I'll also add that we provide everybody with a sample starter portfolio, so five stocks they can get started with. And this portfolio from last year has returned about 34% over the last year. So just a great way to spend your time, learn about investing, and avoid unnecessary risk and losing money.
I'm just thinking, wouldn't life be easier if everything was simple? If it was just a couple of variables involved, that's it. There is a cost and there is a benefit, that kind of stuff, or a cause and effect, probably more accurately there. But that's not the case. And once again, I'm on that side that says you should look at the facts. I get a lot of heat because I say, when it comes to issues like I started off with today, climate change, I say that the fact that you have a climate change challenge does not justify every action, does not mean every action or every policy is equally effective, equally cost effective. And the overriding fact is there is a limitation to the capital available. But that brings me to my shocking stat of the week. What are the causes of death? I'll give you an example. At the UN, Greta Thunberg said, even at 1 degree of warming, we're seeing an unacceptable loss of life and livelihoods. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. Well, is that verified by the facts? And allow me to make clear why this is important. You got to decide if you're in that side that thinks the big concern over climate change is potential loss of life, or are you just simply virtue signaling, or is it a chance to gain political power? See, if you are actually concerned about the impact on humans, then you'll be interested in this. As the following statistics are compiled by the worlddata.org. And I want to just reiterate something I said a moment ago. I was inspired by reading Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation because they're dedicated to making the biggest difference they can globally. So they're tackling monstrously big problems that governments have been unable to successfully do. They're partners too. It's not just their foundation, but remember, they have partners like Warren Buffett and many, many others. By the way, my wife suggested I watch a new documentary on Netflix. It's called Inside Bill Gates' Mind, which spends a lot of time on the foundation. I thought the approach to the problems was fascinating. I'd really recommend it. But I'll give you an example. 1.7 million people a year, all from developing nations, die from diarrhea because they don't have a sewage system to get rid of human waste, which then ends up in the drinking water sometime down the road. So the foundation has spent tens of millions of dollars developing an off-the-grid standalone toilet that can remove harmful byproducts of human waste, which is the main culprit in so many of the deaths. 2 billion people don't have access to clean sanitation. As I said, 1.7 million die a year from diarrhea. That's why the foundation took it on. So that's why they decided that's where the money goes. So let me give you an example of one of the leading causes of death in the world today. Cancers, about 9 million people die a year. Respiratory disease, 3.5 million. Oh, cardiovascular should have been my first one, sorry. 17.6 million a year. Cardiovascular disease leads the causes of death. Cancer is second. Respiratory diseases are third. Something like neonatal deaths, 1.73 million people a year. I mentioned diarrhea, 1.7 million. Tuberculosis, 1.2. HIV AIDS, 1 million. Malaria, 719,000. Protein energy malnutrition, 236,000. Fire, 132,000. Conflict, 116,000. So what about heat-related deaths? Hot or cold, by the way. Heat-related. So it could be hot, could be cold. About 56,000 a year. And by the way, people die of cold compared to heat at about a 17-to-1 ratio. Terrorism, 35,000. And what may surprise you, given the massive coverage, how many people die from natural disasters? Could be earthquakes. That's the biggest factor, by the way. Hurricanes, cyclones, other extreme weather. The total in 2017, 7,000, which is 0.02% of total deaths. So the question becomes, if we were to spend our money, what area would you put it toward to get the biggest bang for the buck in terms of changing people's lives, saving people's lives? Well, you would have to have the information like this. What are the causes of death? You don't have the factors leading up to it. That's what we do with further study. But still, it's very revealing. Ozzie Jurek joins me live on the line. Ozzie, you're going to have to forgive me. This is one of those questions that I'm asking you to sum up stuff that, you know, takes a lot longer, you know, and I appreciate that. So you're going to give us the headline. But I knew from your people that you had just been to Alberta. You were up in Edmonton, I think you were, and looking at a long look at the Edmonton market. So let me just, I know, 25 words or less, I've been invaded by Barbara Walters' ghost. Tell me, difference between Alberta and BC.
Well, I mean, from the real estate perspective, no property transfer tax, no speculation tax, no vacancy tax, no foreign buyer tax. That's just one thing. And then the rest is, of course, prices. If you want to buy a brand new, beautiful one-bedroom condo overlooking a pond, you can get it for as low as $175,000. In Vancouver, you get sort of the front window for that. Right?
Yeah.
So these are sort of the major difference right away. There are some. The other thing that I find interesting is, you know, things are looking up in Montreal and Toronto and Ottawa and slowly in Vancouver. I mean, Bob Rennie yesterday came out and he sees the end of the slowdown in sight. But you know what? Edmonton is changing too.
Well, just so you, I mean, let's be clear. On this show, I've said since June that, yes, the Vancouver market's going to bottom. And the reason was so much of the activity was driven by record low interest rates. Then we got told interest rates were going up. That was the psychology. We got the provincial government adding on new taxes. That changed the psychology. And investment is basically a psychological exercise. And now that it's sort of clear, we have the Federal Reserve has reduced twice. Bank of Canada always talking about, are we going to reduce rates? I think the interest rate fear is out of the market. And then you've got this huge population increase in Vancouver, for example. And I think we'll find in the end, governments have done nothing to help affordability whatsoever. I don't see any sign they've done it. They've made it worse. But I've also, as you and I have pointed out, with the change of government in Alberta, both of us got more keen on the Edmonton, on the Calgary markets and other parts. It's a slow go, but you've also got some population increase in Alberta.
Well, that's the real thing. When you look at 10,150 net interprovincial migrants, you know, just a year or two ago, they used to all come our way. and how are we being, meaning D.C., right? And then 34,400 net international migrants in the first half of the year. My goodness, you know, these used to be the numbers for Vancouver, right? So people are seeing Alberta, and the you know, even a German company, the real estate fund, Deka Immobilien, which is a huge global real estate investor, they just put in $500 million into Edmonton in this Stantec Tower. And then the council approves four new high-rises and a $320 million budget for a recreational center. And then Amazon builds 1 million square feet, you know, and so on and so on. Almost 3.5 million square feet of construction in non-energy-related construction. This is the thing that gets me. We always think it's all related to, if oil doesn't do well, Edmonton won't. Hey, a lot of people are making a lot of bets on Edmonton.
Well, I think one of the things that I know about Edmonton is that, you know, obviously we'd look at employment growth. Well, Edmonton has got, you know, the employment there is now better than it was before the collapse in oil in 14.
Exactly. So that shows, and oil really, the prices haven't really recovered. I mean, we're not back to the lofty heights of before, yet employment is strong. The vacancy rates are dipping. The condo prices, month over month, July to August, they're up. And importantly, the overall listing inventory is down 12%. So, hey, there's still some work to be done. But when I look at the numbers, you know, that, like we're talking about a one bedroom, as I said, at 170. As a buyer, put 5% down if you're a homeowner and you pay $1,400 a month. My goodness, right? This is something brand new. Or the two bedrooms in the 220 range. We don't have anything like that in Vancouver.
Well, I'll come one more. We don't have a lot of time. We'll get a chance at other times to talk about it. But back to Vancouver, because I know the conference board likes the market. As you mentioned, Bob Rennie and Associates likes the market. But I'm saying sort of duh. I mean, when you have a population increase that is consistent and you have a supply problem, that was always the essence. Yeah. Governments have done nothing about that. They are the ones that are behind the affordability problem, you know, in the real estate market. You haven't seen any of them back off and the kind of money they take in. But I still think overall, when you get that population increase, you have built in permanent demand. And at some point, you can get rest periods. But every other time we've had a big drop, we've watched it rebound. And that's where I'm at with the Vancouver market.
You've said it all. I couldn't put it any better. That's exactly it. The thing is, you know, the demand is there, everything is there, but the taxes are crazy. Look, all the losses they had on just on our property transfer tax, on all the deals that we didn't do, say 25%, and then we're taking in a measly vacant so-called speculation tax in relation to all the losses we had on the regular normal business taxes. Apart from the fact that every house itself that we sell or every condo that we sell has withered some $60,000 in the next 3 years and related things that people do, from furniture to legal fees and whatnot. So it's amazing.
Okay, finish. Do you have a quick hot property for me?
Yeah, we had 100 hot properties that we handed out at our conference last week. And we'll send that to you if you want to go to Juroc, JUROCK.com, or go to info@juroc.com, and we'll send you the information. Now, we haven't checked them out, but there's 100 properties in BC and Alberta you could buy for under $125,000.
Wow, you should have told me that was coming. That's a heck of a deal. Just send a note to info@juroc.com. You can go to JUROCK.com, JUROCK.com, and you get the list of 100 properties under $125,000. I'll be doing that right after the show. Thanks, Ozzy. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael. And remember this, if you are in a poker game and you look around to see who the sucker is, it's you.
Absolutely. Victor joins me on the line live from the trading desk. Vic, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I hadn't had a chance in the last week, is to say, how are you handling, you know, this new environment of market by tweet, if you know what I mean? Like, the markets are reacting to tweets.
They certainly are. And, you know, I think a lot of the tweets are political. And what I try to do, honestly, is I do pay attention to the tweets because they can move the markets, but I want to not trade on the tweets. I want to try to trade the market. Maybe it's, you know, one end of the dog and the other end. I don't know. It goes in a circle. I mean, we had an example here on Friday where just kind of out of the blue, that's the thing. You know, you get this tweet to the effect that the, or newsflash, I should say, that the Trump administration is looking at maybe putting restrictions on Americans' ability to invest in China. and also to restrict the listing of some Chinese companies on American exchanges. So really what I see in that is that kind of indicates that this trade war, currency war, whatever you want to call it, that's been going on between the United States and China continues to drag on or escalate. And certainly we had the stock market fall off when that news came out. The Chinese currency went to a new three-week low, near the weakest that it has been. There are these flashes, these things that come out. Now, certainly, say, you know, 2 weeks ago we had the attacks on the Saudi oil facilities. That gets your attention. That's not really so much a political tweet, you know, but it was something entirely different. But then on that thing, the oil price had jumped $9 on WTI, and by this week's lows, that had all gone away. In other words, the risk premium that had been built into the market evaporated. But you have to think there's still some risk premium because those attacks show how vulnerable, you know, the Mideast oil supply is. I think maybe the fact that the market has come back the way it has shows us that the real world demand for crude just isn't what it was when the economy was stronger, say, last year.
Okay, I want to switch gears. A similar thing, though, my observation. Tell me what you think of the gold market.
I think that the gold market has really run up the past few months for a number of reasons. Certainly, it had been ignored, and you know, then people started paying attention to it, and gold has built some momentum. I think the real sort of fundamental driver for it was the decline, the very sharp decline in real interest rates, as we saw, for instance, you know, up to $17 trillion in negative yielding bonds. But the positioning risk on gold right now, we now have the speculators in the paper gold market in New York, the COMEX, have an all-time record long net long position. And the open interest is at all-time highs. What that means is if prices were to fall off a little bit, those speculators probably become selling, and that becomes like dominoes falling. They're selling, creates more selling. So the market is a little vulnerable here to a break. But for the past 3 weeks, it's been kind of sitting or getting down to those levels, looking like it might break, and it hasn't. So there's still a good bid in the market as well.
Well, and again, just a reminder, we're talking about the trading in the shorter term here, not the longer term when you look at that. Vic, can you give me about 30 seconds on what you're doing in the market this week?
Yeah, I was traveling, as you know, last week and into the first half of this week. I was flat, be properly paying attention. Going in toward the end of the week here, I've started to get back in the market and got a short position on the U.S. stock market. It just looks a little vulnerable to me at these levels.
Well, people can go to polarfuturesgroup.com, polarfuturesgroup.com, get the full notes from Victor. Vic, go out and have a great weekend.
Thanks. Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And this is, I don't usually go in this direction, but you may have heard the story. This week, a 25-year-old Surrey man, Nicholas Carvineras, was sentenced after pleading guilty for two charges of dangerous driving causing death, one charge of dangerous driving causing bodily harm. Just after midnight, November 4th last year, in the pouring rain, Carvineras drove his Jeep Cherokee at 167 miles per hour. He got that 167 kilometers an hour, 167 kilometers an hour in a 50-kilometer zone. He crossed the median on 88th Avenue in Surrey, hit a Ford Escape head-on, killing 50-year-old Sarah Dillon, wife, mother of three. Collision also injured passengers 19-year-old Paige Nagata, who later died of her injuries, seriously injuring Olivia Killian, who suffered a shattered spleen, liver, and brain damage. I mean, really, you can't imagine the grief and the sorrow for the families. I do have some personal experience with that, and it tells me the sadness is unbearable, never goes away. But the Goofy's not about the sentence of 20 months in provincial prison, not about the 3 years probation or the 5-year driving ban. For most of us, that seems light, but let's be clear. There's no sentence that can wipe away the loss. And let me also be clear personally, I don't know the sentencing guidelines. I don't know the precedents that have already been set or any other legal considerations that will go into a judge's decision. So I'm not commenting about that. I'm not qualified. The Goofy is about this young man and his driving record that included 7 previous speeding convictions, 2 24-hour driving prohibitions, 2 2-month driving prohibitions, Tickets for using an electronic device while driving, and are you ready? Driving while prohibited. Think of that list. 7 speeding convictions already. My question is, how did he still have a license? How did he get insurance from the Public Insurance Corporation of BC? He should have already been dealing with a lengthy suspension, years. He had already proven he can't be trusted to drive within the legal limits. Now he's killed 2 people, seriously injuring another. Forget the judge's ruling of a 5-year driving prohibition. Why would he ever be allowed to drive again? At some point, your actions have to have consequences. Driving is not a basic universal right. You're not being forced to take transit, walk. You know, I mean, being forced, someone has to walk. Someone has to take a bike or a taxi, maybe someday in BC ride sharing. That's not a major hardship. Millions of people do it already. They don't own a car. They don't drive. How is this person ever allowed to drive again? I mean, what would it take to be banned for driving for life? Our standards of responsibility are incredibly low. I find this unbelievable. By the way, sign up for the seminar right now. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. It's about to start with Andrew Rulin. Protect and prosper through the coming global market chaos.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.